And that is a selection that was written by a friend of mine, Nick Brastos. We really have a variety of people who are going to be contributing to the show. Some of them are musicians, some of them are poets, some of them are authors, some of them, a lot of them are scientists. So as we proceed with the Other Side of Midnight in the next weeks, I'm going to, you know, spring a few surprises on people that they haven't heard for a long time, maybe have never heard. But right now, what I'd like to do is I'd like to go back in time. Dick, are you ready?
I am ready and willing and able to listen.
What I want to do is I want to punch up the audio from a show that we did 50 years ago tonight, covering NASA's first flyby of Mars. And we had some interesting technical aspects to the program. So why don't we play, you know, a few minutes of it and kind of take ourselves back in time to 1965, to a very hot evening in Springfield, Massachusetts, on the night of July 14th, a half century ago, as we reached out to see what was on our nearest neighbor that might hold life.
This is Dick Bertel at the Springfield Museum of Science in Springfield, Massachusetts. Tonight, WTIC presents complete coverage of Mariner 4 as it flies by the planet Mars on an historic photo-taking mission. In the next few hours, many questions may be answered. Tonight, after 8 months of patient waiting, is the night of the encounter. Tonight's program will be an historic first from many standpoints, not the least of which is the method of transmission. Portions of our program will actually be broadcast on a beam of light known as a laser beam, which will be operated by the Perkin-Elmer Corporation in Norwalk, Connecticut. An historic radio broadcast first. Here in the auditorium of the Springfield Museum are gathered almost 250 people, some of the top scientists in the country who will be sharing this microphone with me throughout the course of the evening. The general public is here, too, to learn firsthand what man has been speculating about for thousands of years. What is the mystery of the red planet Mars? We may know tonight. Closed-circuit television cameras are relaying pictures of what is happening here at the Mars complex to other buildings in the area where hundreds of others are gathered to watch these events. In the front of the auditorium is a huge screen on which will be flashed pictures and drawings that pertain to the planet. Here in Springfield, we'll be talking tonight to Dr. Sanford Siegel, noted exobiologist with Union Carbide in Tarrytown. Dr. Siegel has been conducting extensive experiments with life forms on a Martian atmosphere. Also here is Dr. Alan Hynek, noted astronomer and UFO investigator for the U.S. Air Force. We have a direct line to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and you'll be hearing exclusive WTIC reports as well as general reports released by JPL to radio and television networks and to the press. With me now is Dick Hoagland, curator of astronomy and space science at the Springfield Museum of Science. And Dick, what has happened to this point?
Well, according to our information on a pre-programmed list released by JPL and also updated by current activity via our line, the spacecraft has been given about four commands. The first command to start the scan platform, to start the camera moving in an up and down plane to make sure that the motor is turning it so that it may aim toward Mars. The second command later on this afternoon, which stopped the platform at a preset angle so that as Mariner sweeps by the planet Mars at about 11,000 miles an hour, the camera will intercept the planet and begin taking those vital photographs. And just a few minutes ago, just before we went on the air, there was confirmation that the narrow or the wide angle sensor, a large telescopic device is looking at Mars now. For the first time in history, a spacecraft is looking down at the planet Mars, 134 million miles away, as Mariner 4 flies by.
The Mariner 4 spacecraft, which starts shooting pictures of Mars tonight, is just one step in a project that began 5 years ago and has cost about $125 million so far. The 21 or so pictures in this latest shot will cost about $6 million apiece. The ultimate goal of the Mariner project is to make a manned landing on Mars, but this probably won't come until around 1973, and before that step is taken, an attempt will be made to put an instrument package on the red planet to send back scientific data. With its space camera trained on Mars from a range of 9,438 miles, Mariner 4 is scheduled to begin taking the first of its pictures at 8:20 tonight in just about 10 minutes. The last of the pictures will be taken at about 8:45 to 8:50, and at that time, the camera, wearing a 30-power telescope to see better, will be only 6,770 miles from the surface of the planet. The spacecraft itself will make its closest approach to the Martian surface 18 to 20 minutes later. The Earth-sent device will be at that point only 5,412 miles from Mars, and then it will disappear behind Mars. At 7:41 tomorrow morning, our time, the Mariner 4 tape recorder turns on to send about 1 hour of scientific information to Earth across a void more than 134 million miles wide. After that information is cleared, the machine will begin relaying the first picture. Each one will take about 8 hours and 35 minutes to complete. And I assume, Dick, that we'll have those first pictures at about, oh, sometime Friday morning. At least the general public will have them.
Either Friday morning or Friday afternoon, and we're going to be talking more about those pictures later on, but let's wait until we know whether that tape is going to record any yet. You know,
Dick, let's talk right now about the laser beam, which it is hoped will broadcast a portion of this show a little later. First of all, we are not using the laser beam now, and for a very good reason. I wonder if you'd fill us in on the background of that.
It's foggy. The laser is a beam of light just like any other light. It can be stopped by the Earth's atmosphere. The fog is now rolled in across Springfield. We expect it to clear within about an hour or a little less. This beam of light is not like light in that it is coherent. It is like a radio wave or a set of radio waves traveling like soldiers, one behind the other, in perfect step.
Now, Dick, let's take a look at what we hope to discover tonight. In addition to the pictures, of course, which we're all very much concerned about, there are many other experiments which will be conducted tonight, not the least of which is the occultation experiment. What is the occultation experiment?
Well, scientists are very anxious to know more about the Mars atmosphere. As you know, Mars is a planet which has an atmosphere. This can be seen because we have photographed clouds and we have photographed the planet in various colored light, and it appears different sizes.
At this point, I think, Dick, we might call on Dr. Alan Hynek, the noted astronomer and UFO investigator for the U.S. Air Force, who is with us tonight. Dr. Hynek, if I may ask you, first of all, to move into the microphone so that we can hear you clearly. How do you feel about the experiments tonight? I saw a smile of pleasure cross your face, of course, when it was announced that the picture-taking sequence had indeed been started. What are your reactions tonight?
I'd like to be in communication with Kepler and Tycho Brahe. I think they would really, really enjoy this.
Dr. Hynek, I'm going to interrupt here for just a minute, and we are going to talk about the canals on Mars. News is happening in other parts of the world as well, and of course, we want to bring you up to date on that. So at this point, we're going to take 5 minutes out for NBC News on the Hour to return at 5 minutes past nine to the Springfield Museum of Science in Springfield, Massachusetts. This is WTIC 1080 on your dial in Hartford, Connecticut. 9 o'clock.
Be alert to news as it happens on the NBC Radio Network.
Well, that is interesting. How does that make you feel, Dick?
Now I know why my hair is white.
What I want to do in the next segment in a couple of minutes is to play the laser, because this was an innovation that I cooked up with Perkin Elmer.
Remember, yes, you did.
I'm the museum curator. I'm 19 and a half. How's that, Richard, for a residence? I'm working on this exhibit, this huge exhibit that the museum has never done before. I feel like I have no limits. I can create anything I can imagine, and I imagine pretty big. And I get this radio station and this incredibly interesting guy named Dick Bertel to actually come to the museum and cover the encounter live for 5 hours in darkened New England on the night of July 14th. And as part of the deal, I said, wouldn't it be interesting to foreshadow technically what NASA someday is going to be doing instead of using radio waves to transmit information very, very slowly between planets? I mean, we're moving at the speed of light, but the bandwidth, the pipe down which you're trying to send information was incredibly constricted in those days. I mean, 8 1/3 bits per second. So I thought to myself, what could we do during this show that would kind of give people a picture of where we would be going in the coming years of the space program? And I realized that lasers, which of course are a very highly collimated and very powerful beam of light that can be modulated like a radio signal to carry information, would probably be the method of choice of sending data to and from future spacecraft. So I convinced, and again, I'm still not sure how I did this at 19, I convinced Perkin-Elmer to spend a lot of money to send engineers to Springfield out to Proven Mountain to set up a laser link through the atmosphere horizontally, and we broadcast from Proven Mountain to a receiver on top of the museum, brought it down by coax cable, and we mixed it in, I guess, to the mixer, and it was all sent down the pipe to Hartford and then out to that mountain. It was Talcott Mountain, wasn't it, where the transmitters were?
That's exactly right.
See what you can remember? And then we broadcast it all over the air to New England. By the way, if anybody is listening to this program tonight that actually listened to and recorded the show that Dick and I did 50 years ago, I would love to see somebody come up with a copy, because we've only got a half hour of this show. And why don't you tell them, Dick, why we even have half an hour of our five-hour show?
Well, I'll be very honest with you. I knew it was a great show, and I thought, well, you know, this might be a good audition tape for me. So I, condensed it into a half-hour presentation, and that's what we have tonight, or that we're listening to. The rest of the show was discarded as tape was recycled and reused.
My gosh. Let's go back to it and see if we can pick up on one of the laser segments, because that's kind of really intriguing, given what's happened technically with lasers in NASA over the last 50 years.
WTIC in Hartford, Connecticut. This is Dick Bertel back at Mars Complex at the Springfield Museum of Science in Springfield, Massachusetts. We had information from NBC that the tape recorder had not turned off, as you heard just a few moments ago, and this is contrary to information that we have here. So just to confirm it, we have a situation where everything is green, all systems are acting and working properly. We're going to call in Dick Lewis on our special jet propulsion laboratory line in Pasadena, California. Dick, have you heard anything to the contrary? Is everything working as it should?
There is a fear among the people who have been examining the telemetry.
Given.
That the tape recording device may not have shut off after each picture as it was supposed to do. If this was the case, then the total number of pictures taken by the camera and recorded, or the total number of pictures recorded on the tape, would be reduced from the maximum of 21 to a maximum of 7 or 8.
However, there is a considerable amount of optimism that all of the pictures have been recorded and will be played back in the ensuing days.
Dick, I just want to mention that your voice is once again being carried by laser beam here in Springfield, Massachusetts. This is an historic broadcast first. I want to clarify something with you. As I understand it, the tape recorder is designed to stop when the shutter of the camera is closed and then to start up again when the shutter opens. Is that true?
That's right.
All right, so that if the tape recorder did continue and did not stop, there would be long periods of blank spaces, so to speak, on the tape. Is that it?
That's right. It would be analogous to a motion picture camera running when the shutter is, when the lens cap is on, the operator forgetting to shut it off. It would simply mean that not as many, it would come to the end of the roll before all of the pictures had been taken.
All right, Dick Lewis, we're going to terminate our conversation at this point, but I hope you will stand by so that we can call you in again in a few minutes. Thank you, Dick Lewis.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt at this point. We have Fred Stone on our special telephone line now. Fred Stone is with Raymond Engineering Laboratories in Middletown. Fred, I'm sure you've been listening to reports of the Mariner 4's progress, and do you have any theories that you might advance as to the question regarding the possibility that the tape recorder did not shut off between pictures?
Well, as it was mentioned, this is, at this point, just a possibility. The situation hasn't really been proved. But as far as the operation of the tape recorder is concerned, it is under control of the data automation system.
Frank, can you stand by for just a moment, please? We have a direct report from Mariner Control, and then we'll be back.
This is Mariner Control. At the present time, the data from the television period, photographic period, is still being reviewed. There is as yet no resolution of the apparent anomaly between the data information which was sent during the process and the data information which was sent on the basis of stored data after we returned to the mode 2 data transmission.
Fred, I don't know if you were able to hear that report, but the situation is still indeterminate as far as the tape recorder is concerned. Now, I wonder if you'd continue.
Well, Dick, as I started to say, the tape recorder is under control of the data automation system. It receives a start command at the beginning of each picture and a stop command at the end of each picture. These are commands which come to the tape recorder from a system external to it. In a tape recorder, there is one device, a relay, which actually stops and starts the motor. So we have, from our standpoint, two possibilities, an external problem or a problem with this particular relay.
I'm going to interrupt you again, Fred, for another report from Mariner Control.
6:30 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. The Mariner has passed its closest approach to Mars and is now slowly moving away from it. The distance to the surface of Mars from the Mariner is, at this time, 7,163 miles. Repeat, distance from Mariner to the surface, 7,163 miles.
A reminder, you're listening to The Night of Encounter over WTIC in Hartford.
Okay, we can go back to live here. Richard, did you notice something interesting in that colloquy?
I heard a lot that was interesting, but I'm not sure what you're referring to specifically.
Well, what pops up in your mind? I mean, looking back on all those decades of things that have happened, because we were the first guys to actually transmit a space mission, let alone, I guess, any transmission commercially by laser on a commercial radio broadcast.
Well, that's true.
Go ahead.
Let me say something about our references to Mars. We never referred to it as Mars, if you'll notice. It was always the planet Mars, the red planet Mars. Mm-hmm. And I think this was a direct connection to Orson Welles' War of the Worlds that occurred some 22 or 23 years earlier. We were still influenced very much by that program. Did you notice that?
Well, when I heard this for the first time, and I have to describe a little bit of the soap opera in getting this recording for us tonight, what struck me, and when I sent a copy to Art Bell, and he called me back, it struck him too. The whole show had that feeling of War of the Worlds.
Yes.
And it was very implicit in the idea, we've never been there, we don't know what the canals are, we're taking pictures, it's going to take days for them to come back, but we're going to have them. But what we had that we don't have this morning is that live twittering background of what's going on in Mission Control, because unlike the Mariner 4 flyby 50 years ago, this mission is totally silent. There's not a speck of energy or information coming back from New Horizons until 9 o'clock tonight Eastern, when it will turn around, point that antenna back toward Earth across 3 billion miles, and send what they're calling the phone home signal, which is the damnedest way to do a space mission because, as I said earlier in the program, we have been really kind of in clover in terms of getting information about what these missions are doing while they're doing them, for the simple reason that if something breaks while you're doing something complex, the engineers would like to have a record, an engineering telemetry record of what happened up until the problem, the accident. Otherwise, they can't analyze or back engineer or fix the problem. So the idea that we're flying by totally in the blind for the next several hours, and that we don't have a live commentary as to what the spacecraft is doing. Somebody there in Mission Control in Laurel is sitting looking at a screen and looking at a timeline like I'm looking at here on my laptop, but everything is kind of on a pre-programmed clock. We have no information coming back. That, to me, is the weirdest part of this other end of the bookend, because in a way, we've gone backward. The future that I envisioned with the laser transmission of information and data from all over the solar system at very high bit rates has not happened even 50 years later as we're flying by Pluto, and I find that astounding.
Well, certainly they didn't have this program in mind when they set up this project because it would be a lot more exciting had they included that capability. Are you sure that they don't have some backup plan?
Well, see, this is what is so interesting. When you try to get information out of NASA, there appear to be two levels, and we found this over the years in all kinds of areas. There's the level where NASA's letting people know what they're doing. And there's a level where if you start asking too many questions, you're either politely, you know, demurred, or you're turned down, or no one will answer, or whatever. I have been unable for months now to get an engineering answer as to why this spacecraft, this New Horizons spacecraft, with plutonium power source, with power to spare, does not have a few watts to feed to an Omni radio transmitter to let us know not in real time because it's 4.5 hours later, but at least let us know what's going on. So in that sense, we've gone backward. Now, when they turn the spacecraft around, when they actually begin to beam some information home at about 9 o'clock tonight, the data link will be about 2,000 bits per second, as opposed to 8 1/3 bits from Mariner 4. So that means that in about 42 minutes, they can send one high-resolution image from Pluto. 42 minutes. Now, in that 42 minutes, they have to keep the spacecraft aimed at Earth, which means the instruments, other than what's called particles and fields, which measure, you know, the charged particle environment in the vicinity of Pluto, no other data is being recorded or is being sent back in real time to Earth. This is all on the tape recorder, on the solid-state tape recorder in the spacecraft. So at least we've made one advance in that we don't have a physical tape recorder, which can stop and start by signals, and that was one of the problems that we thought had come up that night. But again, the whole tenor of this flyby, 50 years later, is not the open, let everything hang out that we're used to from the public side of NASA all these decades. It's very secretive. So I'm frankly, my conspiratorial link wonders if in fact there isn't a laser on this little spacecraft that no one has told anybody about, and in fact it's sending data home actually simultaneously with it taking data during the flyby.
Well, that would be a nice idea if, in fact, it were to happen. I really can't comment on that, but
There's no way
it would seem to me that we should have a backup plan anyway.
Well, what's interesting, and one of the things that I sent you early on as we were discussing doing the show, is that last year, actually 2 years ago, NASA sent a mission to the moon called LADEE, L-A-D-E-E. Which was a small spacecraft about the size of Mariner 4, put into orbit around the moon. And as part of its experimental payload, it carried a laser for the first time into space for a transmission from NASA of data from the moon back to telescopes at like, for instance, at White Sands and at Goddard here on Earth. And the bit rate was not thousands or a few bits per second. It's up in the millions of bits per second, up in the television, you know, bandwidth of megahertz. And if you can do that from the moon at that incredibly high bit rate, I did a little calculation this afternoon. Pluto and New Horizons tonight, right now, at this moment, this morning, is 13,000 times farther away than the moon is.
That's staggering.
Which means if you apply the old inverse square law, meaning if you put a laser on New Horizons and sent the information via laser back to Earth, you would still have a higher bit rate at Pluto than the DSN S-band and X-band radio link that they're using this morning to ultimately send data back sometime this evening around 9 o'clock. So my question is, why did it take 50 years for NASA, from the time we did our show, Dick, and demonstrated how it actually works? Because part of that previous clip, you could hear the difference between the laser transmission through the atmosphere and the FM audio link that we had to Hartford and back to Talcott Mountain and then on to the listeners. There was a clear difference, but it was obviously very audible and very understandable. And if you were sending computerized data, you know, packets of zeros and ones, you could have an error-correcting code, take out all the noise, and the images and the data would have come perfectly across that laser link, even through the atmosphere 10 miles horizontally in midsummer in Springfield, Massachusetts. So why did they wait 50 years to put a demo not even a real operational system, but a demo on Laddie. And is it, in fact, a tracking of the two-tier engineering to where we only get to see part of the NASA preparation for these missions? They do, in fact, have a secret back channel, and they're able to get data back and look at it long before anybody else does.
Well, what you're saying is that nobody thought to use the laser beam concept until now. Is that what I'm getting?
Well, no, there's been a lot of discussion. I mean, after we did the show, you know, missiles and rockets and aviation and space technology and all the kind of, you know, in-house publications on the aerospace industry, there was for decades discussion of using lasers to send high data rates around the solar system.
Okay.
It never happened. It
well,
didn't
I
happen.
Know. Yeah.
And the question then, of course, in my conspiratorial mind, knowing that NASA really does stand for never a straight answer, that was something, by the way, I learned when I went to the Cronkite people. I was stunned, you know, being this naive 20-some-year-old kid joining the Cronkite folks, to find out that all the CBS personnel covering NASA consistently referred to NASA as never a straight answer. And, of course, then I had no idea why would NASA not be, you know, part of the charter supposed to be giving information freely to the American people under the Enabling Act in 1958. NASA was formed in July of 58. Why would it not be giving straight answers? It took me decades later until I got into this work to realize that NASA, in fact, has a great deal to hide.
You want to expand on that, or is that for another program?
No. I mean, just take a look at these Pluto images. Keith Rowland, I don't know whether we're set up to where if you go to the show page, you actually have a link to a gallery of images. But if you go to the Enterprise website, you know, on the main page, you click on the Pluto link on the show there, it'll take you to our Pluto page. A bit down in the text, there is a set of images, side-by-side comparisons, that came in a few days ago, I think 1 day ago, 2 days ago, and you see this astonishing geometric regularity all over the surface of Pluto. And as I will be talking with one of our imaging experts later on this morning, after we see the next image sent back last night from the New Horizons spacecraft, they've got it here on Earth, but they're going to wait to show us until later on this morning, as a kind of a stand-in for the imagery which the spacecraft has been taking, but it's not going to be sending back to Earth until tonight. In other words, nothing in real time, nothing live, nothing as it happens. It's all stored somewhere in some computer. I was just struck by the geometry that we're seeing, and I said to my imaging guy, his name is Keith Laney, and you'll hear from him in the next couple of hours, I said, that surface does not look natural to me at all. And he, of course, concurs. If you look at the images closely, the new Pluto images, the closer we get at 31,000 miles per hour, the more geometric and the more artificial, I mean, there's no other way to say it, the more artificial that surface looks. And it's kind of amusing to be watching the chats of the various planetary experts, the scientists and the climaticians and the other people who are nuanced in planetary interpretation of data coming from images like this. And they're all looking at natural models. They're looking at condensation. They're looking at nitrogen ices. They're looking at evaporation. They're looking at layering. And in fact, none of them has even on their radar the fact that this stunning repeating hexagonal geometry present now on these images is in fact possibly due to an artificial builder, to somebody who actually left this stuff, which we are now at the end of the last classical planet encounter in the 50-year history of NASA are flying by at warp speed practically this morning.
Dick, can you be more specific as to what is being seen on the surface of Pluto?
Well, Carl Sagan, referring back to Carl, in his book Cosmic Connection, kind of laid out the rule of thumb when it comes to trying to see the handiwork of intelligence on planets other than the Earth. In fact, even on planets like the Earth. Because back during the TIROS program, which was around the same time frame that we did our show, Dick, they launched a series of weather satellites, which were codenamed TIROS, which is, I think, another Greek god. And they took, with analog Vidicon television cameras, the same kind of TV camera that was in the Mariner 4 spacecraft taking pictures of Mars 50 years ago, they took pictures of the Earth for basically weather forecasting. And Sagan and some grad students set up a little project at Cornell, which is where he was at the time, Cornell University, to look through the Mariner, the Tyros Earth weather observation imagery to see if in those photographs of Earth he could spot any obvious indicators of intelligent life down here. And he eventually published a kind of a maxim, a rule of thumb, which was intelligent life on Earth first manifests itself in the geometric regularity of its constructions. Meaning, boiled down, that if intelligence builds something out there, the only way we're going to know, unless we land and find them and walk up and say hello, the only way we're going to find their ruins, their cities, their former evidence of some civilization is if they built like we do in some repeating, recurrent geometric pattern. And then we take pictures of those patterns, and the patterns are so strikingly what nature does not do on both a scale and repetition that we can logically infer that the geometric pattern is created by intelligence.
Okay. Rich?
Yes?
Rich, I've got Alden Tombaugh here with me.
Oh, wonderful.
Would you like to interview him?
I sure would. Okay. Let me give a little backstory. All right, Alden, hang on just for a second. Let me give the audience a little flavor of where we are. Alden Tombaugh is Clyde Tombaugh's son.
Backstory behind you.
And Clyde Tombaugh was the astronomer, the young 22-year-old astronomer, that was plucked out of the cornfields of Kansas in 1929, 1928, and spirited away to Flagstaff, Arizona, to the Lowell Observatory by then-director Vesto Slipher, and hired to actually conduct a survey of the solar system by photographing it with long-exposure imagery through a special dedicated photographic telescope, night after night after night. And that's how Alden's dad eventually found Pluto. So, Alden, would you take it away and describe what happened after that?
As you mentioned, Dad was hustled away to Flagstaff, Arizona, when he was a mere 23 years old.
You're breaking up very badly. Keith, we need to do something.
We're coming up here. Is that better?
That's much better, yes.
Okay. And he spent a lot of time in the observatory, of course, with the telescope, taking star images and then looking at the plates through a blink microscope. And in February of 1930, he found something that moved relative to the star field. He checked that several times, and Planet X was found.
So he basically compared the position of the little dots on the photographic plate with the position of the same dots on another photograph that would have taken hours or days earlier.
That's correct. Days earlier, right. And if all the stars that are out there, the other suns, are in the same relative position to each other, and anything that moves is generally a satellite, and if it moves clearly, it's a satellite generally in our solar system. So that's how Pluto was discovered.
You're still breaking up a bit. I think you're either too close to something or the mic needs to be lowered in volume. This is backstage radio.
Okay, how's this? Is that better?
Much better.
Okay, all right.
What did your dad say happened after he found this? What did he do?
Well, he went to the director's office and told him that he had found their Planet X. And, of course, everybody was elated. There was a little bit of a pause to make sure that everything looked like it was correct. And then later that night, Dad went to the Orpheum Theater, which was downtown in Flagstaff, Arizona, and went to a movie to try to shake off some of the tension.
What movie did he see?
The Virginian, I think it was, something like that.
The Virginian, wow. Yeah. Now, when you say that he went to the director's office, this is Vesto Slipher, because Lowell had long since died. He died back in 1916.
Right. Correct.
When you say he went to the director, that means he had to have been at the telescope all night taking pictures. Then he had to do something that most of this audience doesn't know about, which is to take the film into a dark room and subject it to a chemical process called a chemical bath and a development process, then take the prints or the negatives out of the bath, dry them, and then take them to the director. So this wasn't like a CD image instantly or something you send on Instagram. This was an hours-long process, and he'd been up all night, right?
Well, he was in the phase of doing the blink comparator study after he had taken the photograph several days earlier.
I see. I see.
So it wasn't an all-night deal from the telescope to the blink comparator, but rather a session at the telescope taking photographs and then later developing those photographs and then using those photographs to put on the blink comparator. And that was where all the star images were compared, and he found the movement, which was Pluto.
So
could you explain the blink comparator as to how it works?
Yes, it's back and forth. What you do is you take two different photographs on different nights, and you put one on the left side of the blink comparator, one on the right side of the blink comparator. The blink comparator then goes back and forth from image to image to image to image, and you train your eye over the thousands of star images or thousands of points of light on the blink comparator, which was showing the photographs alternately, and you look for any movement from when it blinks from the right one to the left one and from the right one to the left one again. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very tedious process because you have literally thousands and thousands of light images on each photographic plate. So it's a very intense process.
Well, let me interrupt you there, Alden. Pluto, we now know from your dad's work, was discovered against the star fields of Gemini. I believe it was Gemini.
Right.
And that's in the plane of the galaxy, even though it's 180 degrees away from the galactic center, or almost 180. It's in a region that's not very dense, and yet the stars there were so dense that he had real difficulty spotting something that moved.
Absolutely. In fact, if you go on to any of the internets or any of the encyclopedias, you can see some copies of those photographic plates. And that way you can kind of get a feeling for how many star images there are on each one of those plates. And like I said, even though it wasn't in a very dense region, there are still thousands and thousands of images on each plate.
Now, how long did it take for your dad to figure out how long a Pluto year was?
Well, I think that took some study. It took quite a while before that happened. And I'm not sure that it was anything instantaneous. In fact, it took a lot of study before that was even determined by a lot of people.
Do you know offhand how long?
Excuse me.
Do you know how long?
I'm not actually sure. I'm not actually sure.
Okay, so what happened after your dad went to the movie to calm down? What happened in the ensuing several days?
In the ensuing several days, of course, they looked through other photographic images to see if they could verify the images that Dad saw and identified as a satellite of the sun. And they finally did that. Well, they wanted to make absolutely sure, so they even delayed the announcement for quite a while so that they made sure that they did not make any mistakes and that when the world was made aware that the discovery had been made, that they could verify that with certainty.
Hmm. Now, how did the name come up? Do you know anything about the backstory? And
well,
how
the name
got
came
it?
Up from a girl in England whose father was an astronomer, and she thought that the name Pluto was probably appropriate. Several reasons for that. The PL symbol also was a good tie to Percival Lowell, whose observatory this study was done at, and who'd actually predicted another body in the solar system, although the body that my dad found was in a different place from what Percival Lowell had predicted. And what also is the tie is that the Pluto is the god mythological god of the underworld, and that seemed to be appropriate because they thought probably Pluto was the furthest thing from the sun, and in mythology, Hades was the furthest thing from Earth.
Hmm. Well, of course, you realize today that Dr. Stern and the other team members have been measuring the size of Pluto from the New Horizons cameras. as it has approached. And we now know that Pluto is a little bit bigger, a couple of miles bigger than it was thought, you know, just a couple of 3 years ago, which puts it back as the largest object in the Kuiper Belt, Eris notwithstanding. So how do you feel about the whole planet, dwarf planet thing that happened to your dad's planet?
Well,
very good question.
Interesting controversy. My father would not have been opposed to finding new definitions for objects as long as they were based on a good scientific explanation and a good scientific method of determination. That, unfortunately, was not necessarily the way that the vote went on in the International Astronomical Union in Prague when they demoted Pluto. As a matter of fact, the executive committee had come up with a recommendation which would have included Pluto and Ceres and a few other things. And on the last day of the meeting, there was, let's say it was a consortium of individuals who thought differently, decided that they'd stay and kind of pack the ballot box, if you want to call it that, for the exclusion of Pluto as a major planet. So from the standpoint of a different definition, there's not necessarily a problem with that if it had been particularly based on more science rather than, for lack of a better term, politics.
Hmm. Well, Dr. Stern seems pretty convinced that Pluto should still be a planet. And one of his reasons, which I find really compelling, is that the IAU definition of a planet depends overwhelmingly on where the planet is in the solar system. Now, we're not talking about any exoplanets, any of the objects that we've now discovered orbiting other stars. We're just talking about this system. And according to Stern, if you use the IAU definition and apply it to the Earth, and you move the Earth in your mind's eye, doing one of these Einstein thought experiments, you move the Earth out to where Pluto is, suddenly the Earth becomes a non-planet. Which he says is nuts, because
right.
A planet should be something that's intrinsic. The qualities of a planet should be intrinsically planet-like as opposed to depending upon its environment.
Well, there's several holes in the system, and he is completely correct, and we sympathize with his idea of why it should be a major planet and should not have been demoted. There are several other things that should have been considered in our estimation, and that is that...
Now, hang on. Alden,
yeah.
Hang on.
Yes.
When you say our estimation, who is our?
Let's say it's the family.
Okay. That's a good place to start.
Right. And in the family's eye, what should have been done probably was to think a little bit about what the ramifications of a new definition or exclusion of anything in the major planet category would be. So there really wasn't, in our opinion, a necessity to take it out of the major planet nomenclature and exercise it from the 8 planets that are now assumed, or the 9 planets that we think there ought to be. There's a lot of other reasons that go along with that. For instance, in defining, let's say we're looking at another solar system, and we see objects that are orbiting the sun in that solar system. What do we call them? Well, they call them planets. Under the new definition, they shouldn't do that. But also under the new definition, they don't have enough information on those orbiting bodies to make a determination as to whether they're major, minor, exercised, or whatever else. So, therefore, we think that at some point in time, probably there will be a different definition for a planet that may fit the situation a little bit better. And we think that Pluto and other Kuiper Belt objects will be included in that definition.
Do you think if they find an atmosphere around Pluto, do you think they would classify it as a planet at that point?
Well, I don't know. I can't speak for that group in the IAU that made the change.
Gentlemen,
let
me interrupt. Alden, let me interrupt you. We are now, according to the computer, closest to Pluto that we will ever come probably in our lifetime with the New Horizons spacecraft.
And that means that I need to go in and take a look at what's going on. So I appreciate the interview, and thank you for your time.
Can I ask you one more question?
Sure.
How do you feel from the fact that your dad in terms of his remains, some of them are on the spacecraft and will become the first human interstellar traveler in the modern history of planet Earth.
Well, it's quite an honor, obviously, to have that happen for my dad. And one of the other things that comes up is that even after the Earth is gone, and at some point in time, the Earth as we know it will now no longer exist because of whatever happens, but some change, perhaps a collision with an asteroid or whatever. But my dad's ashes will continue on into space and into the universe unchanged forever.
And he is the first interstellar emissary that I know of.
He's the first one I know of, too.
Well, thank you so much, Alden. Maybe we can connect later in the morning. And
okay.
Congratulations. Your dad started something really cool.
I appreciate that. Have a great day.
Okay, Dick, did you want to say anything?
Well, I wanted to ask you, you were talking about designations of planets, and one of the definitions is that a planet should be able to clear the space within its own orbit.
Yes.
Now, does Pluto not do that?
Well, because it's technically at the inner edge of the Kuiper Belt, which is this second asteroid belt that begins around 39, 40 times the Earth distance from the Sun and extends out another, you know, I guess up to maybe 50 times the Earth distance. There's this ring with highly inclined objects also orbiting in it, called the Kuiper Belt, and Pluto is part of that. So no, it is technically not cleared its orbit because there are things in the Kuiper Belt that could come and smash into Pluto. So that's why the IAU put that definition in there that it needs to clear its own orbit. However, as I said a moment ago, as Alan Stern points out, if you were to move the Earth-Moon system with its existing gravitational field out to the orbit of Pluto into the Kuiper Belt, it would not, in the history of the solar system, have gravitationally cleared its orbit, in which case Earth as a planet suddenly is demoted to a non-planet. So the definition is really kind of cockeyed, and it was done, as Alden said, politically, and there are possible reasons that have to do with what we're looking at on Pluto that may be one of those political reasons. The other reason may have to do with Lowell himself. When Alden said a few moments ago that his dad found Pluto, but not at the position that Lowell had predicted mathematically decades before, that's not exactly totally accurate. It was close enough for folk music, as we used to say. And when you're considering a sphere of 360 degrees all around the heavens, or you're considering an orbit 360 degrees measured as completely around the sun, the odds of finding this little speck in the place where Tombaugh found it on those first discovery plates on that night in February of 1930 is overwhelmingly against, even though it isn't exactly within, you know, a few arc seconds of where Lowell had predicted. I mean, the mathematics gives you a kind of a room for slop, a room for error. Mm-hmm. So there are many, many other astronomers who say quite bewilderingly that somehow Lowell managed to correctly predict where Pluto would be found, but in fact the physics of Pluto as we now know it has turned out to be totally insufficient to cause the movements of the outer planets Uranus and Neptune that Lowell used to mathematically predict where Pluto would be. And so they clock this up to a great, Richard, you'll love this, a great cosmic coincidence.
I see. That Pluto had, of course, nothing to do with the anomalies that really don't exist, by the way, of Uranus and Neptune.
Well, now, after the Voyager flybys a few years ago and the accurate measurement of their masses and their positions and their orbits, it turns out that the mathematical errors that Lowell put in his papers predicting the location of Pluto were an error.
Yes.
Pluto, not only didn't the movement of those objects take place as he reported, but Pluto is far too small, far too insignificant in mass, it turns out. I mean, it's only two-thirds the size of the moon, even if it is a couple of miles bigger now than we thought, you know, last week. And so gravitationally, it is completely incapable of providing the kind of perturbations that Lowell reported in his papers back in the teens and the latter part of the 19th century. So the question then arises, how did he make the biggest, most successful prediction if it was based on all the wrong information?
Well, certainly I can't answer that one, Dick.
Well, let me raise a possible heretical thought. And we're coming up to 8 o'clock Eastern, and I believe NASA is going to do something rather dramatic about this closest approach, because now the spacecraft New Horizons is flying along a little over 7,000 miles away from Pluto. About the same distance, by the way, that Mariner 4 flew by Mars 50 years ago. And then NASA is planning at the top of the hour to come in with some updates, some new news, some hopefully actual. I mean, wouldn't it be amazing if they actually say, hey, we got some data? But I don't think they're going to do that. They're going to tell us what they think the spacecraft is doing. But again, totally unlike the Mariner encounter or any other planetary encounter that I've been part of for the last 50 years, we are literally flying blind. We're flying in the dark. We do not know if this little thing, the size of a baby grand, is going to hit a speck of dust or ice orbiting Pluto, and that will be all they wrote. Because unlike other planetary missions where you get a lot of data back in real time, given that they're only able to record about or send home 1% of what's on the spacecraft, it's going to take them the next 16 months. Let me repeat that. The next 16 months to send the data that New Horizons is recording of the Pluto system all the way back to Earth to be complete, uncompressed, redundant, and all of the things that you want from a spacecraft, which is obviously never coming home again.
And of course, New Horizons will continue to move into the Kuiper Belt and eventually into outer space
in
as
the next,
that happens.
Well, it's already in outer space. I mean, we can argue about definitions. You mean interstellar space.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, this thing is moving very, very fast, but even at those incredible speeds, it's going to take it years to get to the next destination, which is one of the, what they call innate Kuiper Belt objects, an object maybe a few hundred miles across. They've got three choices. They can do the burn in a few weeks after the Pluto encounter. That will change the trajectory of the spacecraft. It will then fly by, I think, in 2017 or 2019, this Kuiper Belt object that they have selected. They've got two, I think, now they're looking at. One is bigger and one is smaller, but one is easier to get to and the other one takes more fuel. And obviously you want to preserve fuel because, remember, you have to spin the little spacecraft around to point the cameras and all that. So if you use up your fuel on your trajectory burns, you won't have any fuel left for attitude orientation. So you want to manage that budget, and this is all going on with computers behind the scenes, and I'm sure they will come out with their decision probably in the next few months. But they do have time to make that decision. They don't have to make the decision of which Kuiper Belt object now New Horizons can get to, because they've got two choices, and those choices will remain open for the next several months until they have to make the decision.
Is it fair to say that these two objects they're considering are what we would call asteroids?
Well, they're icy asteroids. We don't really know what the composition of the Kuiper Belt objects are. What we're getting is superficial, you know, surface spectroscopy. But as everybody knows, if you coat something with even a few millimeters of stuff, you're not going to see the bulk composition. You're going to see what the surface coating is. So we don't really know, and you won't get real data until you get close enough to see if there are holes in the coating. But a lot of these objects appear to have water ice on them, frost, very, very cold, like 400 below zero. I mean, really, really chilly out there. And that's why it's so remarkable that Pluto, which is a little closer, has an atmosphere, has some kind of apparent geological activity, and appears to be a functioning planet in every sense of the word. Well, we had Alden, I was going to bring up a possibility to him, and maybe I will if we can get him back later in the morning. But his dad went through all the politics after the fact, after Pluto was declared the ninth planet, and I wanted to get into a bit of that history with him, but we didn't have time before this announcement coming up. Keith Morgan, do you have an update for us on what's going on there at Mission Control? What are they gearing up to do?
Yes, they're about to start the announcement here. So I'm going to give you guys the live audio.
Okay.
They're at the podium.
Okay. So we won't go to break. We'll go directly to Mission Control. Take it away, Alan Stern.